Good afternoon, and may it please the court.
Good afternoon. Henderson. I'm sorry, your name? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Sonam Henderson for appellant James Ignatius Diamond. And aspirationally, I plan to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And I'm planning to focus on the district court's errors in admitting the customer complaints. But of course, I'm happy to answer any questions on the other issues that the court might have. So one of the key pieces of trial evidence against Mr. Diamond were dozens of written customer complaints containing vituperative assertions untested by any cross-examination about what Diamond had promised to the writers, about how the writers had been evicted or otherwise harmed as a result of Diamond's activities, or just showering invective on Mr. Diamond. So for example, these complaints included an email asserting that Diamond had promised the writers she would never be evicted, emails saying that a family was being evicted on Christmas Eve, leaving a child homeless. Multiple emails repeating a claim that Diamond had caused 40 people to lose their homes, and a denunciation calling Diamond's programs one of the most fraudulent pieces of work to ever hit the Southland. Importantly, some of these complaints asserting promises had not been kept came from the alleged victims of specific counts who did not testify. So, for instance, an email from Roy Wells saying that he and his wife had not gotten what they thought they'd been promised. This is important because, as you know from the briefing, the government only called 2 out of, I believe, 9 alleged victims that it identifies in the indictment. So this is a way of piping their voices, the voices of these missing witnesses, into trial. The district court's admission of these complaints involved at least 3 errors. 1, they're hearsay. 2, even to the extent they could be introduced, they're immediate. Non-hearsay purpose, failed to instruct the jury about that, and finally they violated Rule 403 because they were far more unfairly prejudicial than probative. Jumping into hearsay, the general bar on using out-of-court statements for the truth of the matter asserted is perhaps the most basic rule of evidence. It exists to ensure that evidence is reliable, that in particular that the jurors aren't hearing evidence that's not being tested by cross-examination. Here, the customer complaints were out-of-court statements offered for their truth, even in as much as the government frames them as being for notice.
Well, counsel, weren't these complaints subject to the limiting instructions given by the judge?
I can jump to that, Your Honor. No, there was a limiting instruction given that concerned a different set of evidence. So on ER 651, 652, when the government is trying to introduce a set of bank rejection letters, totally separate set of evidence, the district court told the jury the government is submitting these letters for a limited purpose, for the limited purpose of showing that the defendant had knowledge of these rejection letters. He's not introducing them for the content of these letters. So the instruction was about the letters, about the rejection letters specifically. And it comes before the emails are even introduced, so it's not like it's referencing back to them. And then,
Had the district court just given the jury and the same jury limiting instruction with respect to the admissions of other exhibits, as Diamond contends should have accompanied the customer complaints, and because the government specifically referenced that contemporaneously expressed limitation when seeking to introduce the complaints, it likely was not an abuse of discretion, it would seem to me.
Well, no, Your Honor. Looking at that, you're talking about, I believe, about the colloquy on ER 658, where Mr. Reedy said, Your Honor, at this time I ask that Exhibit 601, 605 be admitted for the limited purposes stated to the court to show knowledge. Yes, Your Honor. Defense counsel briefly interjects, Your Honor. Then I'm sorry. Notice, Your Honor. And the court says, notice, okay. So, two things. This is a colloquy between the lawyers and the court. None of this is addressed to the jury. So, I mean, it's a lot to ask that the jury is listening to this and paying attention. The court never turns its head to the jury and says, okay, this is coming in for a limited purpose, as I previously told you. It doesn't make any reference back to the previous instruction. It doesn't address the jury at all. And then, as I'm looking at this, you know, all the court says is notice, okay. That could be, from the jury's perspective, that could be acknowledging the government's request. It's not even particularly a formal granting of the government's request. So it's, I don't believe that's enough to inform the jury. I mean, certainly the government talking about a limited purpose, the government has no power to instruct the jury. The instruction comes from the court. And in fact, in the instruction that the court gives the jury, it specifically tells them, if the court tells you something is being received for a limited purpose, it can only be considered for that purpose. The court doesn't tell the jury this can only be considered for a limited purpose. To the extent that message is being passed to the jury at all, and as I said, I doubt it, it's coming from the government. The government has no authority to do that.
Were you the trial counsel?
I was not.
Oh, I'm just wondering how it was argued to the jury.
In terms of?
Well, when the lawyers were making closing arguments, if they it's only admitted for this purpose.
I think it's actually a very good question, Your Honor, because if you look at the government's closing argument, you can see that they feel in no way bound by this instruction in their use of the customer complaints. This instruction would say that, you know, they're not being introduced, but if you applied it to the complaints. And so instead of letters, it says he's not introducing them for the contents of these complaints. In other words, what may or may not have been inside the complaints. He never says that, he says letters, but let's say he did. The government, in its closing argument, highlights the contents of the letters, going over the stories of evictions and foreclosures.
Was there a defense objection?
During closing?
Yeah.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there was. But, I mean, again, I'd say that's because there was no, you know, the fact that the government's using it that way and the fact that the defense is not objecting, I think both indicate that nobody understood that limiting instruction had been applied to this set of evidence.
Paul, the court said that. But, I mean, the court said it was only admitting it for the limited purpose.
No, it didn't, Your Honor. I'm sorry to cut you off, but on ER-658, it doesn't say, okay, I'm only admitting this as a limited purpose of notice. All it says is notice okay. That is not saying I'm only admitting it for that limited purpose.
Can I take you to the sentencing? The government concedes certain error there, but says basically you're not going to do any better. And I'm concerned that, let's just say we say the error was, I think it's your challenge to the four-level enhancement, right?
That's the one the government concedes. I'd argue that there's error across the board there. I mean,
if you go back, there were things that you could get more time, couldn't you?
Sorry?
If you go back, if we vacate this and you go back, your client could get more time.
Potentially. I mean,
You're not supposed to be, but I don't think when you ask to vacate it, because there were things that the government asked for previously that the court really quite didn't get to, because I think those of us that have spent time in a courtroom sentencing, either as a lawyer or as a judge, know that there's sort of a sense of, well, I think it deserves about this amount of time, and there's a little bit of that's, so it's probably likely it's going to be the same sentence if that's what the judge thought your client should be. But on the other hand, sometimes you can't get to the same sentence if you can't use a certain one, and there are other ones out there that I'm looking at could, your client could get more. I just noticed that.
I disagree with the government's argument about more. I don't think they've shown a whatever it would be, a substantial number of vulnerable victims. They really didn't prove up the circumstances of almost any of his clients. The only clients that we have information about, their you know, non-hearsay information about their personal circumstances are the four who testified. Of those, two of them were financially stable. I think Baldwin was owned multiple homes and a business, and Hatoumian, you know, said that he was financially stable, not behind on anything. He just took a flyer on this to try to get a windfall. Only two of them, Garza and Glaviano, seemed to be in financial distress. So the government put two people in financial distress. It didn't do a wide survey, or at least not that it introduced, of the circumstances.
Well, if we vacate it, they can do whatever they want, can't they?
They could do whatever they want, and we could also make our arguments and
right.
Get a better hearing from the court in terms of you know, our arguments about Mr. Diamond's age and the fact that he had such a long law-abiding life before becoming an adherent to these conspiracy theories, which I certainly think contributed. I know that, you know, the government argues that that's somehow inconsistent with the verdict, but it, you know, it's clearly not. You could truly believe in these methods, but oversell them and you know, commit fraud that way. So I think there's certainly room for these arguments that the court, there's no indication that the court paid any attention to, that it didn't make the specific rulings that were required. It didn't demand evidence from the government where that was required, and it certainly didn't explain.
Well, I think you argue for your client that the district court's explanation of the sentence was inadequate. But what is the specific argument or factor that you think the judge was required to but did not address?
He didn't address anything. We come in, we make arguments based on the 3553A factors. Again, I think focused on his age and the fact that he had been a law-abiding citizen for many, many years before becoming an adherent to this sovereign citizen philosophy. And I think there's a complex, interesting question that deserved explanation there of, you know, if you're somebody who's...
Well, it wasn't verbose. I would agree with you on that.
He's not verbose, and there's stuff in there. And if you look at, like, Trujillo, I believe is the best case there, you know, you don't need a lot of explanation. The court's been clear about that, but you need something. And there really is just nothing here. He doesn't, you know, in shorthand, in any form, explain what he's doing.
You want to reserve your time?
I'm saying that I'm at 3, so yes.
Let me just ask if any of my colleagues would want to ask any questions here.
No question.
Apparently not. So why don't you reserve your 3 minutes? Thank you.
Thank you, Donna.
We'll give you 3 because we talked a little bit to get you down to 258. Okay, thanks. All right, let's hear from the government then.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Kevin Reedy on behalf of the United States. With regard to the complaints, Your Honor, I think that the record, a fair reading of the record shows the complaints were not admitted for their truth, but they were rather admitted to show notice to the defendant and the complaint's effect on the reader. The government requested and received a mid-trial limited purpose instruction that rejection letters and complaints were not introduced for the truth of their contents. And those two requests were made at excerpts of record 651 to 653 and excerpts of record 658. And then again, in closing, the government reiterated that the complaints were admitted to show that the defendant was on notice that his methods did not work. So I think that there is an explicit mention, explicit tying of a complaint letter to the prior notice instruction during the...
Were you trial counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, I was.
So what did the defense, when they talked about the complaints, what did they say? Do you remember?
Your Honor, I think we made this argument in our brief, the defense essentially accepted the core truth of the letters, which was that the people had complained to the defendant that he had lost their, that they had lost their homes. And I think the argument that the defense made in closing was essentially that the defendant was not the cause of the of his customers' loss of their homes. Rather, it was the Great Recession. And also they chalked up the lack of response to the complaints to poor customer service rather than the defendant's awareness that that he had engaged in a fraud was the reason why he was avoiding his victims. So I think that those were the arguments that the defense made, at least in their closing, with regard to that issue.
Okay.
And also, I think the court has already pointed out, the defendant did not make an objection or ask the court to read the limited purpose instruction at the time that the complaints were admitted a second time, because it was not necessary to do so. The government asked the district court to admit the complaints on the same basis as the rejection letters, only a few moments after the court admitted the rejection letters on a limited basis and admonished the jury as to how the jury was to consider evidence that were admitted on those bases. I think that the defense counsel's discussion of the back and forth between the government counsel and the judge sort of loses sight of the fact of the temporal proximity between the request for a limiting instruction on the rejection letters and the requests related to the complaints. And Your Honors, I do just want to make the point that the admission of the complaints, I don't think it was unduly prejudicial. It provided important context to the jury to evaluate the defendant's behavior and his intent to defraud. And also the substance of the complaints were relevant to the type of the notice that the defendant received regarding the potential issues with his methods and their consequences to the people he claimed that he was trying to help. Also, I want to say that this evidence was not cumulative. There was evidence at trial that the email address that received the complaints was used exclusively by the defendants. And I think that testimony is at excerpt of record 446. And so the complaints provided an important corroboration for the primary cooperating witness, the defendant's office manager, Tricia Gruber, and also provided the jury with a basis that was independent of the often sometimes problematic baggage that accompanies a cooperating witness. It provided the jury with a basis other than that cooperating witness to find that the defendant was on notice that there were significant problems or potential significant problems with this scam.
So go to the sentencing. You concede error, but when I look at your brief, you seem to argue that we should affirm the district court's imposition of the four-level enhancement for causing substantial hardship to five or more victims on the ground that the district court would likely impose a six-level enhancement on remand. But the district court previously rejected this argument, so why is it inevitable that the judge would change his mind on remand?
Your Honor, I think that there's two potential bases for our argument that essentially if the court should not error with regard to the substantial hardship enhancements under the plain error standard, because essentially the guidelines range, the government believes that it was calculated correctly. The first, I think we should say, is that the application of the substantial hardship to five or more victims who suffered substantial hardship enhancement was supported by the trial evidence. Testimony from victim Juana Garza, as well as Pauline Glaviano, who testified about her victimization, as well as that of her husband, Frank Glaviano. And also there was testimony from the defendant's office manager, Tricia Gruber, who said that multiple victims had complained to the defendant about losing their homes. And under those facts, this case is very similar to the court's opinion in the George case, in which this court affirmed a substantial hardship, an even higher enhancement with regard to substantial hardship to 25 or more victims, based on evidence of multiple distressed homeowners who paid fees of between $1,000 to $3,000 and who later lost their homes after participating in a fraud. Here, the evidence at trial showed that the defendant collected between $2,500 to $3,500 from each victim, and that's at excerpt of record 372. And also the evidence at trial, specifically the testimony from the victims, as well as the testimony from the defendant's co-defendant, showed that many of these victims later lost their homes. And I think that testimony alone would be enough to find that the substantial hardship to five or more victims was appropriately applied in this case. And Your Honor, with respect to the other bases that the government argued in the alternative below, I understand that the courts did not accept those enhancements. However, I think it's a unique situation because the court could not apply both of those enhancements. I don't think it's fair to characterize a record that the district court ruled that the substantial 10 or more victims and large number of vulnerable victim enhancements. I don't think the court ruled that the facts did not support those enhancements. I think the court rather applied the substantial, the five or more victims with substantial financial hardship enhancement. And because he did that, the guidelines prohibited him from applying the other enhancements that the government sought. However, I think that the record does support application of those enhancements. And if that were the case, and if the loss amounts remain the same, which the government also contends would be the case, then the
if he get more time if he goes back,
I would say that that it would be a good possibility that he would receive more time. I think that the evidence does support additional enhancements, and I think that the government would be within its rights to argue for that. Your Honors, unless the court has any further questions about any other issues, I'm happy to answer them. However, otherwise, we would just submit on our brief.
It does not appear that Judge Owens or O'Scanlan have any additional questions. So thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of points. One, in terms of sentencing, I mean, the district court, in addition to the enhancement for vulnerable victims, the district court didn't make a ruling on the loss amount. And the loss amount, I mean, there's some real reasons to question that. One, there was no evidence put in at sentencing. The government points back to evidence at trial. But the number at trial for loss was quite different from the number at sentencing. At trial, it says 1.8 million. At sentencing, it says 1.4 million. I understand that's better for us, but it also draws into question their whole loss calculation, you know, methodology and logic. If they're dropping, you know, $350,000 with no particular explanation, it's not clear where that came from. And when you look at the actual testimony in court, it's just an agent saying, look, I assigned these payments as being from customers based on some criteria that another agent gave me. There's not a lot of evidence there to work from. So it is, I think, entirely possible that had the court, you know, address that, you know, specifically instead of just this loose, well, I adopt the PSR generally. So if it had done what it was required to do under Rule 32, I think we would have, we may have gotten a different result on that as well.
Counsel, if we were to remand, are you willing to run the risk that he may get more time?
I do think the court made errors at sentencing, and that I would like to see a sentencing hearing that was conducted properly under the procedures that are laid out under the statute and rules, and I think we would do better, or at least not worse. And I do want to jump back to hearsay for a minute, because this really, the notice that the government is talking about here really just isn't a non-truth purpose. Even here, they're talking about the substance of the letters being relevant. I mean, the substance of the letters, you know, if it needs the jurors to treat as true that people were really being evicted on Christmas Eve, people really losing their homes, people, Diamond had really promised people they'd never be foreclosed. Because if those factual assertions aren't true, it's not clear what the notice is. You know, what are they being, what is he on notice of unless those factual assertions are true? And I would just point that the cases that the government points to about notice, in those cases, the underlying facts are being proven through other means. Where the notice is true, that the underlying facts are being proven by other means. And I'd point you to, say, Phillips, which is the land fraud case where the government puts in 10 complaint letters to show notice that the sellers had gotten these complaints, but also put on 25 live witnesses to testify to the same issues about the ads being misleading. So, and we don't have anything like that here. They're not proving it up through other means. I see I'm over. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted.